I'm Montse Alvarado. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, Race Against Time. Search and rescue crews are looking for survivors of the deadly flooding in Central Texas. We have the latest. Changing course. President Trump delivers an update on U.S. involvement in the war in Ukraine. Politics and religion. A major decision from the IRS that could impact churches across the U.S. Plus, cave people. A report from an annual pilgrimage for the faithful in Norway. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us today on the Feast of St. Suniva. We begin tonight with a message from the mayor of the town devastated by the Texas floods.
Over and over, I've asked you to pray. It occurred to me that I haven't asked you for what to pray specifically. Please pray for those who mourn, for those who wait, and for those who help.
Mourning, waiting, and helping. All three on display in Texas as the damage from the devastating floods comes into sharper focus. The number of deaths has climbed above 100, and crews are still searching for the missing. Meanwhile, many others are without homes, businesses are gone, and the future is unclear.
What now? You know, what am I going to do now? I don't know.
But even through the worst of it, resilience and solidarity stand out as people come together to help those who are suffering so much. One group, the United Cajun Navy, is a group of volunteers helping in physical and spiritual ways. Joining us now is Brian Tratcher, Vice President of the United Cajun Navy. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. Now, can you give me a sense of the damage that you're seeing?
It's catastrophic. It really is heartbreaking. It reminds me a lot of Hurricane Helene in Western North Carolina, where you had the high-speed hydrokinetic flood waves flowing down hilly terrain and into valleys, where it took out structures, property, and unfortunately over 100 lives so far.
And you're there on the bank of the Guadalupe River. Obviously, that's one of the central places where you saw great devastation. What have your interactions been like with the people of Texas?
Well, you know, as far as the agencies and the joint command that's working, they've been really top-notch. A lot of places that we go, we end up there because the response is inadequate. That's not so in this case. We're just force multipliers. Texas is doing a great job of coordinating with Department of Homeland Security to do these search and rescues, and we're just helping out. It really is. You know, I'll give you an example. I was at a restaurant last night that had a very large dining room, pretty full of people, but you could really only hear silverware and plates clinking. People weren't really talking, you know. So I think the entire community is heartbroken. It's a very somber scene here.
Are you seeing any signs of encouragement from the community of rebuilding efforts, even though they're still in the middle of search and rescue?
You know, everybody I've talked to, when it comes to rebuilding, that's just sort of like a foregone conclusion. They're not even upset that they have to rebuild. They're more upset about the dozens of little girls who were at the camps. And, of course, more than that, of just people from the general population or people who were adults who were camping and RVs and other places that were just woken up to rushing floodwaters in the middle of the night, never really had a chance.
And of the things that you're doing, what would you say are the most essential parts of what you're adding to the relief efforts?
Well, I have we brought our chaplain with us, and he's got decades of experience in bereavement counseling for trauma victims. And he also brought another counselor that specializes in counseling first responders. You know, when you have events like this where there's children involved, you see a real spike in the suicide rate amongst first responders. So we're trying to have all those bases covered and have not just the search and rescue aspect of this operation, but the spiritual aspect to make sure that people, the victims and their families, the community at large, and then, of course, my team stays spiritually grounded.
Well, we'll be praying for your efforts, Brian. We know that they're really important. Thank you for all that you're doing. Brian Tratcher, Vice President of the United Cajun Navy. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The torrential rain that devastated Camp Mystic and other rural spots came with extraordinary speed. The Guadalupe River and its surrounding areas in Texas Hill Country have historically been prone to flash flooding, earning the nickname Flash Flood Alley. But this weather event is among the worst in its history. At one point, state officials reported the river had risen 26 feet in just 45 minutes. For more, let's bring in Texas State climatologist Professor John Nielsen Gammon. Could you explain why this area is nicknamed Flash Flood Alley?
Sure. You've got, unfortunately, the geography and the meteorology contributing to this. The terrain is very rugged, and the soils are shallow, so water runs off fairly quickly. The streams go downhill fairly quickly also, so you have that rushing water that you just heard about that can carry people away. And then meteorologically, the moist air that comes into the central United States coming from the Gulf reaches the hill country first. That's the first obstacle it encounters, and that tends to trigger thunderstorm activity. So you've got warm, moist air from the Gulf being forced to wring out its rainfall over terrain that can't hold it.
Now, Professor Nielsen Gammon, this area is prone to flooding. So why did they build in these lower locations?
Well, if you've ever been there, you would understand it, because the rivers are lined with beautiful cypress trees. Under ordinary circumstances, the water is just a trickle. People float in inner tubes down the rivers every summer. So it's really one of the most beautiful spots in Texas. And unfortunately, it's those rare occasions when a flood happens that it turns from beautiful to tragic.
Well, many survivors have said that this took them by surprise, that they had no way to receive emergency warnings. What can be done in the future to warn people about an extreme weather event?
We have two main tools at the moment. One is alerts via cell phone. I've heard people say that the cell phone coverage is kind of spotty out there, but if you've got areas at risk, it would certainly be useful to have extra cell phone towers to make sure everybody who's there that has a phone is able to get the information. And then they have to be receiving alerts and not have them deactivated if they don't want to wake up in the middle of the night. Sirens can help also, but those are very nonspecific. You still need to be able to turn to some specific information to know whether to stay in place or to move to higher ground.
Well, that's an interesting thing that needs to change. Obviously, we are all turning off our cell phones in the middle of the night, but various officials have referred to this as a 100-year flood. But we keep reporting on extreme weather events. When do we say that this is a new normal, something that we have to get accustomed to?
Yeah, the analyses of extreme rainfall that we work with are based on the historical record. But we're basically working on an analysis for the state of Texas now to update that and take into account the trends in extreme rainfall that we've seen all across the South and Southeast United States. And what we found is basically what used to be a 100-year rainfall event is now more like a 50-year rainfall event. But the floodplain analyses haven't caught up with that, so we're trying to move the needle forward and make sure we're ready for the floods of the future.
Well, we'll be looking out for that analysis and hope that you get to it quick. Thank you so much, Professor John Nielsen Gammon.
Thank you.
President Donald Trump will head to Central Texas on Friday. He confirmed his travel plans during a cabinet meeting with top administration officials. Among those in attendance, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, who is leading a federal response to the deadly natural disaster. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen?
Monse, President Trump covered a wide range of topics at that cabinet meeting today, but he first asked his DHS Secretary Kristi Noem to address the devastation in Texas. She described it as heartbreaking and that they're still looking for people.
We're still looking for a lot of little girls and other family members that were camping along that river. They will continue until they find every single person, and we will continue to help them and assist in that.
But in the midst of tragedy, the presence of God.
I'm extremely grateful for God's hand in that whole situation, because hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people were saved. God created us to take care of each other, and that when we do that, we are happier, we are more fulfilled, and we can walk alongside people on their worst day.
Among the many other topics discussed at the cabinet meeting, tariffs, a key date coming up fast. And President Trump says the U.S. is collecting a record amount of money from tariffs.
And then the big money will start coming in on August 1st. It's about time the United States of America started collecting money from countries that were ripping us off, and laughing behind our back at how stupid we were.
President Trump also praised the passage of the big, beautiful bill that he just signed into law.
What we're doing is saving our country and making it much bigger, better, and stronger than it ever was.
And President Trump meeting again with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to discuss Gaza. His ceasefire negotiator reports progress that could lead to a lasting peace.
So we are hopeful that by the end of this week, we will have an agreement that will bring us into a 60-day ceasefire. 10 live hostages will be released. 9 deceased will be released.
At today's cabinet meeting, which was broadcast live, President Trump called Gaza a tragedy, adding that there's a lot of long-term hate, but he's confident it can be solved with a real solution that he believes can hold up. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Thanks so much, Owen. Well, the president's cabinet meeting comes fresh off of receiving a high honor from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he came to the White House for dinner.
I want to present to you, Mr. President, the letter I sent to the Nobel Prize Committee. It's nominating you for the Peace Prize, which is well-deserved.
Netanyahu says he nominated Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work forging peace in one nation after another. The president added that the nomination was very meaningful. The leaders praised the work of both nations in combating the Iranian threat. Prime Minister Netanyahu is also on Capitol Hill, meeting with congressional leaders after some lawmakers accused the Israeli leader of trying to drag the U.S. into another war. That comes after President Trump's decision to strike 3 locations central to Iran's nuclear program last month. Netanyahu met with House Speaker Mike Johnson after he postponed a trip to Israel in June to address the Israeli parliament as the war broke out with Iran. The Israeli leader also met with a group of bipartisan Senate leaders. Lawmakers have introduced several measures seeking to restrict President Trump from taking further action against Iran without approval. The Senate voted down a war powers resolution by Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, while other measures have yet to receive a vote. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, including a waging debate. Lawmakers consider whether to make a change to the paychecks of hourly workers. And President Trump makes a U-turn with a surprising announcement about the war in Ukraine. Trump took time today during his cabinet meeting to express frustration with the war in Ukraine.
We're not happy with Putin. I'm not happy with Putin. I can tell you that much right now, because he's killing a lot of people. And a lot of them are his soldiers. His soldiers and their soldiers, mostly. And it's now up to 7,000 a week. And I'm not happy with Putin.
This comes shortly after President Trump asserted that the U.S. needs to supply Ukraine with more defensive weapons. This represented a change after reports last week indicated the Pentagon was suspending the shipment of some weapons to Ukraine. Joining us now is William Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and distinguished fellow with the Atlantic Council. Ambassador Taylor, it's great to be with you. Your reaction to the president saying the U.S. will send more defensive weapons to Ukraine?
Well, so that's exactly what needs to happen. The Ukrainians are holding off the Russians. The Russians are invading Ukraine and are ready to go further. And so providing the Ukrainians with the weapons they need to stop the Russians where they are is definitely in our interest. So this is a very good decision.
Well, now we heard President Trump say he's not happy with Putin at all. How will this impact negotiations for peace, the ability to have a conversation?
The negotiations will happen only when President Trump puts real pressure on President Putin. And it sounds like President Trump is realizing now that President Putin is the problem. President Putin is standing in the way of President Trump's signature effort to stop wars, in particular, stop this war that Russia is fighting against Ukraine. So Putin is the problem. President Trump now understands that. It's clear. And so he needs to take action. Not just words, he needs to take action to provide those weapons and to put sanctions on the Russians to make them stop the war and come to the table.
Now, with the provision of these weapons, what kind of impact will they have on Ukraine and the war at large?
The big thing will be morale. The Ukrainians are being battered. The Russians are every night sending thousands of 100, 500 a night. So thousands over weekend of drones and missiles every night. So Ukrainians are spending virtually every night in bomb shelters. So the big thing will be morale. But when these defensive weapons come, these Patriot missiles that can knock down these incoming guided missiles and ballistic missiles, when they come, that will save lives. That will save, in particular, civilian lives, but also protect infrastructure that the Russians are attacking. So this could help the Ukrainians stop the Russians in their fight.
This war has been going on for years now with the provision of arms from worldwide interveners. How do you think the prospect for peace or an end to the war looks right now?
It looks possible if, as I say, the Americans, we Americans, put pressure on the Russians, in particular on Mr. Putin. When Mr. Putin understands that he can't win, when Mr. Putin understands that that our determination and the Ukrainian determination and the European determination is more than his, that he will lose, he will come to the table, and that's how this will end.
Thank you so much for your time, Ambassador Taylor. We appreciate your analysis.
Thank you, Monsi.
Now over to the Middle East, where the Trump administration has revoked the terror designation of a group led by the new president of Syria. President al-Sharaa, shown on the left, is the leader of Syria's transitional government. He also led the Islamic rebel group HTS. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the move recognizes the positive work being done since the ouster of Bashar Assad late last year. HTS received its terror designation before it split with al-Qaeda in 2017. A report accuses allies of the new Syrian government of committing violence and discrimination against Christians and other religious minorities. The findings are from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. The report, released this month, says Syrian rebels, many associated with the HTS Islamic group, engaged in mass killings and other forms of persecution. The new Syrian government says as it moves forward, it's committed to protecting religious liberty. Back in the United States, a proposal would allow pastors to endorse political candidates without losing their tax-exempt status. The Internal Revenue Service and a Christian media group are asking a Texas court to stop enforcing a rule that bars tax-exempt groups from political endorsements. The Johnson Amendment also applies to churches. In 2017, President Trump signed an order to limit its enforcement. Republican lawmakers have since pushed to repeal it. A movement is underway on Capitol Hill to possibly raise the federal minimum wage. Several lawmakers say the American dream is out of reach for many who can't keep up with inflation. Now, two senators are urging Congress to take action on their bill. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales has more.
Good evening. Republican Senator Josh Hawley and Democratic Senator Peter Welch want to double the federal minimum wage to $15 per hour with automatic increases for inflation. They say it's long overdue, and they want the wage increase to start January 2026.
The minimum wage hasn't increased in 15 years, but right now, adjusted for inflation, it's at its lowest level since like 1950. Nobody can afford to buy anything. I noticed that these corporations are happy to raise prices on everybody all the time.
Senator Peter Welch, a Democrat and co-sponsor of the bill, wrote in a statement, quote, "We're in the midst of a severe affordability crisis. Every hardworking American deserves a living wage that helps put a roof over their head and food on the table. $7.25 an hour doesn't even come close." It's gaining support from Democrats.
It's been really hard lately, so I hope that Senator Hawley succeeds in this, and I'm glad to help in any way I can.
This is not a radical idea. The overwhelming majority of Americans support raising the minimum wage to the living wage. Doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or independent. People support and understand that workers need a living wage.
Senator Josh Hawley wants to increase the minimum wage for federal workers, and your thoughts on that?
I don't think it's a particularly honest effort. He's voted against minimum wage increases pretty repeatedly.
GOP leaders argue that increasing the federal minimum wage would only end up raising costs for businesses, which in turn would make local goods and services more expensive for consumers. Some economists estimate that it could cost over 800,000 jobs.
When you raise a minimum wage to $15, you reduce the number of people who can get a beginner's job, work at a fast food restaurant, work whatever the case might be in the service sector or otherwise. So I just think manipulating markets with mandatory wages doesn't make any sense.
By the way, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops says it's a moral imperative to support a living wage so that people can live decently, maintain a family, and acquire property. Both Senators Hawley and Welch are lobbying Republican leaders now to bring up the bill quickly. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, a piece of history in England. Find out why a Catholic Mass was celebrated at an Anglican cathedral. Plus, learn all about Jubilee events taking place for the faithful in Norway. In England, as the Papal Nuncio to the UK celebrates Mass at the Anglican Canterbury Cathedral. The Mass commemorates the feast of the translation of the relics of St. Thomas Becket. According to local media, yesterday marked the first time in modern history that the annual Mass was celebrated by a Papal Nuncio. The 2025 Jubilee is not limited to Rome and the Vatican. The Catholic Church has designated various other pilgrimage sites worldwide where the Jubilee indulgence can be obtained. One of these is located on a small island in northwestern Norway. EWTN Vatican journalist Anthony Johnson has more.
The cradle of Norwegian Christianity is making waves in Norway. On the island of Selja, Catholics of countless nationalities come by boat for a pilgrimage to commemorate the feast of Norway's only recognized female saint, Saint Soniva. Soniva was a 9th century Irish princess whose trust in God brought her here to this island and whose witness inspired Norway's first Benedictine monastery.
This was where the cross of Christ first arrived in our nation and in our country. So to be here is to celebrate our history. The development of Christianity, the coming of Catholicism to our country. And we use it now as part of our build-up to the anniversary in 2030, 1,000 years of evangelization.
This year's pilgrimage marks the first time since the monastery's closure in 1537, during the Reformation, that Norway's two bishops from Trondheim and Oslo are present on the island at the same time. Selja also joins Catholic shrines and cathedrals across the globe, in offering plenary indulgences to pilgrims during the 2025 Jubilee Year of Hope.
It felt logical, I think, for all the Catholic bishops in Norway to designate this as a site of pilgrimage, a Jubilee site, for people to come and to refresh their faith.
The Feast of St. Soniva began with the faithful praying and walking the pilgrim trail, from the harbor to the ruins of the Benedictine Monastery. A frequent pilgrim to Selja, newly ordained Father Matthias Ledum looked to St. Soniva on his own vocational journey.
And I came here on a pilgrimage, and I just felt the intercession of St. Soniva very strongly for my vocation, and given her story, you know, going from Ireland and setting out in a boat without any oars, without any sails, and just letting God take control.
Upon the death of her father, Soniva received advances from a pagan suitor who would pillage her kingdom as punishment for her refusals. She and her companions thus left Ireland and set sail, letting the wind, sea currents, and their trust in the Lord's providence decide their fate. After arriving in Selja, they sought shelter in this cave to escape abuse and advances of more heathen foes.
And they prayed to God to be spared from this, and then the cave fell down on top of them, so they died.
Many years later, according to tradition, a light was witnessed emerging from the cave and over the whole island. The cave and the relics within it emitted a lovely fragrance.
So there were signs that, okay, these were holy people. And then this place became the seat of the first diocese in Norway. Her relics were here. The seed was planted, and you can see now, many, many years afterwards, that you have the living faith of Norwegians today. It's such a great pleasure to be here and to seek their intercession still, and to continue to pray for the conversion of Norway.
In Selja, Norway, Anthony Johnson, EWTN News Nightly.
Before we leave you, we invite you to respond to a request from Notre Dame Catholic Church in Kerrville, Texas, to pray a nightly rosary for the victims of the flood, the families still searching for loved ones, and the first responders and volunteers. We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Montse Alvarado. Good night, and God bless you.